You're listening to Spark My Muse with your host, Lisa DeLay.
I love it. I don't know why that makes me so happy, but that's perfect. So, yeah. So, also, yeah, so give people listening, like, the 411. Who are you? What do you do in brief? And, yeah, what are you up to?
Okay. Well, I'm Carrie Rappaport. I'm 42 years old. I've been living in Los Angeles, California for the last 11 years or so. And I'm currently just graduated from UCLA and really, really happy about that. Yay! And right now, just getting ready to go study at Cambridge for a couple months, and then I come back and win the world again. And hopefully doing something in communications, hoping to sell a TV show or two, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. And you've done a lot of different things in terms of vocal performance and voiceover work. And I have only caught sort of bits and pieces as we reconnected on Facebook. Because Carrie and I were neighbors and went to high school together. And then, you know, when you pop back up on Facebook, I was like, whoa, what's Carrie been up to? What is this life, this crazy life? And I was like, this is cool. So I started poking around, and then I saw that you had these pictures of you, like, rock star singing in with your tat sleeve. And I was like, dang, she's so cool. And so maybe you could back up a little bit and talk about some of your singing and some of the stuff that you were involved with, and then what got you out to California.
Sure. Well, I was born and raised, as you know, I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and I would call it bad luck, but I guess everything happens for a reason, exactly how it's supposed to happen. Mm. I ended up in West Virginia and Ohio for a while, but got married, got divorced. I was extremely young. It was an extremely short marriage, and got to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is where I ended up staying for about 8 years, and that's where I started singing. Mm. And in 1997, I think it was, I had my first band, Taffy, which then developed into an all-female group called Boo Boo Kitty, and then I joined a band called Juiced, and we ended up doing pretty well in South Central Pennsylvania and toured all over Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, went all the way up to New York, went all the way down to Florida, played MTV Spring Break at Club La Vila in Panama City Beach. So that was fun, but I really wanted to do original music. And that was, even though we were able to be full-time musicians, which was extremely fortunate. Mm. But I really, really, really wanted to write. And at that time, original music wasn't taking off in Central Pennsylvania. So I ended up going out to Los Angeles in 2005. It was February 2005. I moved out, and I've just been out here ever since. And joined a band called Cake Cutter pretty much as soon as I came out here. And they had already had music on shows like kind of like the Jackass shows, mm-hmm. and Wild Boys. And so they already sort of had a connection for music placement. So we wrote an album's worth of music, and one of our songs called Fly ended up in the Jackass number 2 movie, which was pretty cool, mm-hmm. and on soundtrack. So we did that, but I moved on. More original bands, that kind of faded out. I've just been doing sort of cover bands here and then and now. I now am the lead singer of a Faith No More tribute band called Faux No More. So I get to be Mike Patton, and it's awesome. It is awesome. He is my vocal hero. So getting to pretend to be him for, you know, an hour is just great. Oh. It's awesome. I've just been doing that.
That's awesome. And that means you have a really good vocal range, because those songs are like belting it out and total rock star, So you're all over the place with your voice then. Do you really take care of the instrument then?
I do. I try to do a lot of vocal warm-ups. I try to do a lot of vocal rest when I can. Mm. I'm blessed with a 4.5 octave range, so that's helpful. But ever since I was a kid, I was a mimic. So I'd go around the house doing, just pretending to be a DJ, because that's what I initially wanted to be when I was a little girl. My dad was one, and he used to work at KDKA and WJET up in Erie. And so I'd go around the house saying, "Hey, folks, how's it going? Here's Mom and Dad reading the paper and drinking coffee. All right," because that's how DJs talk. You know? Every single one, even the women, apparently. So. But I've, even with my cover band things, that was where I got my notoriety. Was I was able to go from, say, Gwen Stefani of No Doubt right into Phil Anselmo of Pantera. And that's a lot of fun because it provides me with a lot of flexibility. I've got a short attention span. I like doing a lot of different things, so I'm not pigeonholed into anything, which is kind of cool. So now it's fun because Mike Patton in Faith No More, I mean, he's got an incredible voice and can go from melodic to complete screaming. And yeah. he's just the coolest. He's absolutely the coolest. So I'm thrilled to be able to get to do it, even for the little bit that I get to do it.
Yeah, and that really plays into what you can do with voiceover work too, doing a lot of different characters and coming up with a range for whether you're doing like little kids or, and figuring out accents and things like that too. Does that play in? How did that merge into voiceover work then?
When I was a little girl, my father, after he got out of being a DJ, he owned an ad. So whenever a copy would come across his desk with kid, then he was like, "I know one of those." And so he'd come home and say, "Hey, Carrie, you want to get out of school coming up on Thursday?" And I'd say, "Yeah." So I ended up doing a lot of voiceover work in Pittsburgh. Oh. So that was really great because I did AAA, Pie Tree Pies, Gibble's Potato Chips. You remember Gibble's Potato Chips. That's totally an East Coast thing. And by doing that, I was able to join AFTRA. And the funny thing is that when I got older, we sort of got out of that. I got out of advertising and into sales. So my in, so to say, was sort of on. And at that time, I'd lost interest. When I came out here and started picking up voiceover again, I said, maybe I should join AFTRA again and see how that works. So I called the Pittsburgh AFTRA office, and sure enough, they had me on file, but they had to go in the basement and dig through boxes, and they found me on microfiche, if you can believe that. So what was neat was that I got reinstated for, like, super cheap, and by that time, SAG and AFTRA were thinking about merging. So maybe a half a year later, SAG AFTRA merged. So I got into SAG without paying anything. I got grandfathered in, paying only like $60. It was insane. Oh. So luck of the draw.
You know, I'm realizing that some people are going to have no idea what these letters are. And
oh, a Screen
listening.
Actors Guild. I'm sorry. I'm sounding all hip and cool in Hollywood. Hey, SAG. You know, SAG. And AFTRA.
You're a Hollywood superstar. But and then the other one's for voiceover work.
Yeah, the SAG and AFTRA are both. It's combined now, and it is all for voiceover. So
okay.
Or singing or regular acting in front of the camera, whatever I choose to do. I try to stay away from the camera. This is probably the first time that I've been in front of a camera in a while on Skype. But I prefer staying behind. I can be in my pajamas that way.
Yeah, and to do work, you do need to be part of this. It's like a union, right? Is that how it is?
It is a union. Mm-hmm. It is a union. I don't necessarily have to be part of it to work. Mm-hmm. Because there's plenty of non-union jobs, but in order to get the good stuff, yeah, you have to be union. And I'm fortunate enough to have an agent, the wonderful the wonderful Lisa at 90210 Talent. She's been fantastic. And so that's been great so far. It's just it's just plugging away. I'm gonna have to take a hiatus when I go overseas. I had to email her and just let her know, unless they handpick me and say we want this girl, just give me my weekends to go travel and my weeks to stay in and study.
Yeah, and so Cambridge is part of your UCLA stuff, or is that something you're doing on your own?
It is part of UCLA. I was fortunate enough to have a friend suggest that I go. It's part of their UCEAP program, which is their education abroad program. And even though I walked this past week, I actually have my graduation pushed up to the end of the summer because I wanted UCLA to pay for me to go overseas.
Smart.
So that was part of the plan. So I'm getting to finish up three courses at Cambridge, which is great. Even though they're sort of extraneous, I don't need them. Shh, don't tell anybody.
No one will just be between us.
Your millions of listeners.
Take and, off a few zeros there, but
that's all. But I didn't really need the classes, but I'm taking the opportunity because I'm living like a 21-year-old at 42. This is all part of the things I should have done had I not chosen a life of rock and roll debauchery.
And speaking of debauchery, that's our perfect segue. So
excellent.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on this because I know that you know, part of your story is coming out of substance abuse, and I was wondering if you could touch on that and talk about when you decided that you wanted to come clean, and how did you do it, and what was that about?
Well, primarily, I started late and ended early. I was extraordinarily fortunate.
Yeah.
I was, if you remember anything about me in high school, I was pretty straight-laced and a total square and kind of a dork. So all of that, of course, led to the reasons for getting to drugs and alcohol is sort of to avoid all that.
Well, I know you
didn't. Feelings of, you know, associated with.
Well, I didn't think of you as a rock and roller with a sleeve for sure in high school. Even though we were both in art club, you weren't like, you know, like scary or anything. You weren't like, you didn't like strike fear into anyone or anything. You didn't seem like a rock and roll, like, oh my gosh. So
I was
such
a
surprised.
Nice girl. It was so sad. It was so, what happened? It wasn't until like junior and senior year where I actually started spreading my wings and actually embracing being different and being, you know, being somebody that didn't cling to mom's side. So when I went to Syracuse University for about a semester and a half before getting a 1.926 because I partied so much. As soon as I got to Syracuse, it was my main motivation for going was getting away from my mom because she was very controlling, she didn't really let us have friends growing up, if that makes any sense. So getting away from being under her thumb was too tempting to, you know, not do. But when I got there, since I really had very little of a social life background, I completely went overboard and ended up in lieu of class. Well, these were my choices. I could go to class at 8 a.m. in 2 feet of snow, or I could sit in my friend's dorm room and hang out all day and potentially drink alcohol. Well, that's... this is a hard, hard choice. And at that time, it was, you know, alcohol won for me. So I ended up hardly going well. I shouldn't say hardly. I did manage an A minus in English, so that was good. But I had like a C minus in French and a D in biology. It was terrible. It was just awful. So I ended up coming home, and of course my parents were really upset, and it got really, really bad at that time because my parents were going through a divorce. And it was pre-divorce. It was, we're not happy with each other. Dad's sleeping on the couch while mom's upstairs in their room. And it was just, I was spreading my wings and going down. I don't know if you remember Oakland at all. Hanging out at the Beehive.
Oh, yeah.
I found all these bohemian kids there, and they would say things that seemed so foreign to me, like, dude, can I crash at your place tonight? Yeah, okay. And I was like, oh my God, people can do this? That's still how square I was. It was just ridiculous because I was... So this was such a foreign concept because I still lived in Upper St. Clair at the time. And so I ended up partying with those kids and ended up leaving home. Actually, I was under the influence of drugs. That was totally the reasoning behind my choice. I left in the middle of the night because I came home and my mom was so about grounding me for the littlest, smallest things. Pretty much to ensure that I couldn't have friends. And I wasn't really doing anything crazy. And it was just, I knew at that point that I had to leave. And if I didn't leave, I never would. And I literally packed up a couple sweatshirts, tied a pair of shoes around my shoulders, had my notebook and some, you know, a little bit of money. And I walked to my friend's house on the opposite side of Upper St. Clair. And, she drove me down to Oakland, and then I lived as a bohemian for about a year, and then sort of got everything squared away, moved to West Virginia in the Panhandle, fell in love, and moved in with a guy, and that's where my addiction really sort of took hold. And it wasn't really... you know, anything super serious. All I was doing in comparison, I was a huge marijuana addict. And in addition to marijuana, I was doing a lot of acid, speeders, not drinking much because he was an alcoholic, but just did drugs instead of drinking alcohol. So I did drink some, but it was hidden from him, or at least I thought so, which, of course, it wasn't. We all know that that case wasn't. But just lived in, you know, we had a $225 a month apartment that we still couldn't come up with rent for. That's what I remember. And just, you know, lying to my father when he'd call because I had gotten back in touch with him at that point. Not being able to look at myself in the mirror, that was hard. And when my boyfriend he just turned to me one day and said, I think we're addicts. And I said, okay. And that was as much as it took. I didn't have to do any huge crash and burns. I didn't really have any trouble admitting that I was an addict. And so we started going to 12-step programs in Wheeling. But even so, I got clean on March 15th, 1995. Oh my God, it's been that
time flies.
It has flown. So yeah, March 15th of 1995. That's it.
Yeah, and do you, yeah, and it's,
yeah, so.
So you didn't have this, like, you know, you find yourself in a stupor on the street or something like that. You just realized, I don't want to live like this. This isn't, this isn't, you found yourself in a pattern where you realized this isn't really the real me, or this isn't how we want to do it anymore.
Yeah, this was my trigger moment. I was slowly slipping into just, you know, it got to the point where we couldn't have fun without weed. Mm-hmm. I remember we missed so many things because we were going around town trying to find, you know, something, mm-hmm. and we couldn't. And I remember we were getting into things like credit card fraud and things like that. That were just, it wasn't me. Mm-hmm. It never felt like me. And I'm very thankful for my boyfriend at the time to have been able to point that out and just say, listen, this isn't working for us. Mm-hmm. We're addicts. And it was definitely not a problem for me to say that, because I just knew. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easy getting clean. I mean, but I did quit cold turkey and go mm-hmm. to meetings. But I will say, the first year after I got clean, that's when I made all of my worst decisions.
Oh, get out of here. Well, why do you figure that happened?
Well, they say that you should never, you know, like, don't make any huge decisions the first year. That's sort of like the mantra. And everybody thinks they know better. And well, that's for everybody else. But I know better. I had broken up with my boyfriend at the time and ended up going to, what happened then? I went to Steubenville, Ohio, had a wonderful year did my stint as an exotic dancer, which was, you're like the first person that knows that right now. So this is inside info, mm-hmm. but got married, moved to Brookfield, Ohio, when my husband at the time had said, we can't live on our own. Let's move in with my parents. Mm. Here's a hint: when your husband says to do that, it's really a bad idea. It's really bad, and you should say, no, we're doing fine in our $300 a month apartment. I don't see why we need to live with your parents, who are all Catholic, and your brother is a priest. So they're not going to be judgy at all. And every argument won't suddenly turn into five against one, including your brothers.
Oh, gosh.
That was a great time.
That's before or after the exotic dancing?
That was after.
Okay. I was going to say that could also complicate.
That was after. But they weren't too happy about that. So
yeah,
I ended up divorcing him, moving to Lancaster because that's where my dad lives. Mm. And he said, just come here, get reestablished, and get your own place. He was very, very adamant about, you're going to get your own place within a few months. I'm like, okay, no problem. I can do it. Mm-hmm. And soon after I did get everything all squared away, I just realized music is exactly what I want to be doing. Mm-hmm. I had a husband at the time that was, he was a producer and he was a live audio engineer and lighting guy. And he had toured with, he did bus driving too. He had toured with the Goo Goo Dolls and with Rusted Root. And he was really very egocentric and very cruel, and had kept saying, there's no way you'll make it in the music industry. You're not good enough. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. So once I had a bit more time under my belt of clean time, then I realized that's all bunch of ridiculous nonsense. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why I can't do it. And it's basically, I started with the karaoke thing. because everyone's like, oh, you should sing, you should be in a band. I got tired of people saying you should be in a band. So I said, okay. And went to do that and eventually got to be able to do it full time. So that was cool.
Well, with being in the music business then later, then you're really surrounded by a lot of drugs and alcohol then at that point, right?
Absolutely. My job was to get people drunk and then get them to hook up. In that order or not. That's really, I was a seductive jukebox. That's all I am.
Right.
And so it's, if anything, for me, being around all the people going, you know, whoa, yeah, you know, that's, it's a total turnoff, especially when you're sober. It's right. Just like, oh my God, I don't want to be that. And I'm very thankful that I'm not that. Mm. But it's hard to not feel ego and superior to that when that's your job. You're hired by bars, mm-hmm, to sell beer. Mm-hmm. It's whether or not they like music is completely, mm-hmm, you know, it's regardless of that fact, you know, it's completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. They can easily get a DJ. Mm-hmm. They can easily get a comedy, you know, mm-hmm, a bunch of comedians to come in. So they're choosing to bring in bands because that's what makes people buy beer. Mm. People come, they want to dance, they want to rock out, they want to, you know, go talk to that pretty girl in the front row, so they go buy her a beer. That's the idea. So I never forgot my role with, mm, that, because my band could easily be replaced with another band. Mm-hmm. So, plus, not everybody is an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Just because you drink doesn't mean that you have a problem. I do. Mm-hmm. And my addiction is not just drugs and alcohol. I've always said my addiction is more. Mm. I want more now. Yes. You know? So
yeah,
it's a matter of I have to stop my head from telling me to spend too much money or to spend too much time at work or, mm-hmm, to procrastinate or, you know, because my addiction sounds a lot like me. So I can convince myself of the most ridiculous, incredible things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a constant balance. It's constant work. Mm-hmm. And just being aware, and I still fail a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm not relapsing or anything like that, but my addiction definitely rears its ugly head often.
Yeah, I think sometimes people call it avarice, is that more, like you're saying, that's one that many, many, many people have. So it's like knowing balance. So it's like, I'm not going to watch TV. I'm going to binge watch 12 hours worth of whatever, or I'm not going to be on Twitter a little bit. I'm going to be there until I can't see far away because I've been on,
absolutely,
my phone. Right.
Yes.
So do you know, does it sound familiar to me? A little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. My boyfriend gets really upset. I've had to really watch myself. Cause we're huge soccer fans. So we support the LA Galaxy and we have season tickets. So we'll go, but I'm engaging with my friends online, mm-hmm, who are also Galaxy fans through Twitter, making comments and snarking on something stupid that happened, or, you know, somebody missed a shot. So of course I have to make fun of that person. And in the meantime, I'm missing the game and I'm missing the fact that I'm sitting with my boyfriend and enjoying this time that we've paid good money for. And it's stupid. It really is. So I've really tried to limit myself to, okay, I'll do halftime. Mm-hmm. Okay. Only if somebody made an egregious error, you know, but it's what do they say? Progress, not perfection.
Yeah, do you find that as you get older, you get better at this? Are there any kind of practices that you felt like you've been able to embrace that help you along in this? Or, because I think a lot of people, I mean, myself included, a lot of people are like, I need to figure out how to balance things because I know that I tend towards this. So, for some people, it's going to be that they can't pass up a sale at the store, or for some people, it's going to be that they can't finish. I mean, that they can't eat one or two or 10
Sure,
potato
sure.
chips, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I know I have a food addiction. There's no doubt I have a food addiction. And coming to terms with that is very hard because your body tells you you need this food. And you're hungry now and you need nourishment, which you really do. It's just a matter of how you nourish yourself. And my problem is that I know that if I eat, say, pasta with pesto, I'm gonna feel great. I'm going to feel bloated and gassy and horrible later, but I will feel good. My stomach will feel full and I will get those feelings that I crave. To me, it's this empty hole that is in my body or in my soul that I'm constant. It's a vacuum. It's this endless black hole of a vacuum that no matter how many things you try to put into it will never fill up. And so it's very hard to avoid that when you know A plus B equals C. I am hungry. If I eat a Twinkie, it's going to be really delicious. And C, I'm going to feel good after. The problem is that there's the extraneous, well, this is bad for you, and sugar's bad for you, and fat's bad for you, and trans fats are bad for you. I will pay the consequences. Sometimes I'm okay with it, but sometimes I'm not. So I just try to achieve a balance. What's hard for me is, well, as I get older, I think it's not so much I get wiser, but it's the way that I look at it is the wick to the can, the wick to the explosive gets longer. So it's not me, I'm gonna light this and see what happens. Boom, it exploded in my face. I feel stupid. Oh, that was dumb. Why did I think that something different was gonna happen? Now I light the wick and then I have some time to sit and think, is this what I really want? Is this a good idea? What are gonna be the repercussions before it gets to the explosive so I can snuff it if I want? It's not a knee-jerk reaction anymore. But I fail a lot. I'm a perpetual smarty pants. So if I see an opening, a lot of times if instead of saying, going through the motions, okay, is this true? Is this necessary? Is it kind? I'll just react because my ego gets in the way and says, you need to be funny. And to heck with anybody else who gets hurt because at least you laughed, or I need to feel smarter than this person because they're being dumb in my eyes and I need to make them feel bad. That's ego. That's stupidity. That's self-centeredness.
Yeah, we all do that. Oh my gosh. Yeah, all the time.
Social media is terrible for that. It just provides a platform with extraordinarily little repercussion where you could troll anybody and anyone at any time and get very little real life blowback.
Yeah, and
and
in like 3 seconds you can say something horrendous with your thumbs in 3 seconds and get a real ping of joy, and then like, oh, maybe that was a bad idea.
absolutely, but that's addiction to me though. It's basically whatever is knee-jerk reaction to something that could potentially harm yourself or others, that's absolute addiction. And I've said some stupid things in the past week where, I've deleted them and I'm like, oh, that was just, why did I do that? Mm-hmm. That's not what this person meant. Mm-hmm. I should know that's not what this person meant. Assume kindness, assume positivity. You took it as a personal attack. It wasn't a personal attack, but that's all addiction. And all you can really do is just acknowledge it as quickly as you can, mm-hmm. make amends where possible, and really, you take personal responsibility and really make an honest to God effort to not do the same things mm-hmm. moving forward.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And it is kind of a matter of like cultivating awareness. I listened to the One You Feed podcast with Eric Zimmer, and he talks a lot about, he does a lot of Buddhist practice, kind of like not religious Buddhist practice, but like secular Buddhist practice that have to do with cultivating awareness. And I have gotten a lot out of that because it's just the practices of like just stepping back for a little bit and being aware of your thoughts and being, and not being so tied to them that they're completely unawake, that you're just like in a dream and you're not, and you're just, everything's a reaction instead of a response. But man, especially for like, I think we're similar in that, in those ways where you're just either it's nature, nurture, it's probably both, where you're just kind of from, I don't know, came from a family of hotheads anyway. And so, everything was kind of like, could go up in flames at any second, like, whoom. And so you're kind of used to like, fighting dirty and all this stuff. So everything has to be like unlearned. And then you're like, oh,
absolutely.
Instead of being just this wild animal, I actually am going to have to think about something before I say it. And I'm actually going to have to be really kind.
And that's what, that's what separates humans from animals anyways, is the ability to not act upon instinct.
Yeah.
It's the ability to take the time. And, I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's part nature, part nurture. I mean, my family was a family of alcoholics. Mm. So, and their parents were alcoholics. So I had the wonderful genetic predisposition. Yay me. And it's a matter of what you do with it. Mm-hmm. It really is. I think if you, I'm very thankful that I was made aware of it early on. Mm-hmm. My father got sober when I was 16. Oh. So he's now, my gosh. So I'm, do quick math. Is that 27 years, 26 years? Mm-hmm. So he's got 5 years of time on me. But I remember when he would, I remember one time when I was 16 and he had just started going to meetings, and I was washing dishes at the sink and looking out, and it was miserable, gloomy day. I'm like, ugh, so ugly out today. It's a terrible day. And he said, every day you're alive is a beautiful day. And coming from my dad, who was one of the most cynical, bitter people, I looked at him like he had three heads, because this was completely new vernacular for him. And he's stayed sober all of this time, but I'm thankful that even for him, he got out when he did. I'm thankful that I got out when I did. Mm-hmm. But it's that a matter of, there's a difference between being aware of the fact that you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, but also taking on that personal responsibility instead of saying, oops, my addiction. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that really, if that's any of my criticisms for any 12-step programs, it's a lack of responsibility, a personal responsibility. Mm. And I feel sometimes that they treat it as this extraneous, outside, intangible thing. Whereas one thing that you're given, once you get clean for some certain amount of time is you get your choices back.
Hmm.
And you don't have that when you're in addiction. I get that. I totally understand that. And when you're even after you stop using and you're still in the throes of addiction for quite some time, and I'm talking like immediate hard grip. So first few years, you're not making good choices and you don't have the ability to make proper choices. You're still chasing after that feeling of what's going to not. You're chasing after what's not going to make me feel or what will make me feel normal or okay. And so, you know, for a while you're to me, it's like, you're not responsible for those times. You know, I mean, there's a certain level, but addiction plays a huge role. After that time though, you know, you're going to have to live with the rest of the world. You're going to have to understand that bars exist. The billboards with alcohol advertisements exist, you know, commercials with alcohol exist. So you have to live within that, and you're going to have to be that person that goes to functions. And when people say, "You don't drink," you have to be the one to say, "Nope." Really? Not even just beer? Nope. And that takes responsibility, and that takes an understanding and awareness of who you are and the knowledge that, well, you know, you have the choice. You can choose to drink. It's just a bad choice. I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I don't have that choice anymore to drink. Oh, no. I always have that choice now. It's just the last choice that I want to take.
Somebody said fantastically, was talking about, I think it was in regards to like sin and heaven or something like that, but it was the most awesome illustration, and you could relate it to addiction as well. It was like, do I have the choice at this very moment to go right now and drink out of the toilet?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do.
Yes, that's, I do. But will I? Fantastic. No, I will not.
That's exactly.
And it's like, that is kind of the truth when you're talking about something that's really poison to you. You do, at this moment, I could go over right now, because I'm allowed and I'm an adult and I can do anything I want. And I could go over to the toilet right now and get, it would be cold and everything, and I could get a glass of water out of there. But I know that's a really bad idea.
Sure.
And I'm plan to not do that ever. You know, like, and it's the same kind of thing. Once that clicks for you, that's a really bad idea. And once you know better, I think, unless there was some crazy situation, you probably will never do that if you're in your right mind. And so I think it kind of can work like that. There can be a moment where things click for you. And you're going to say, I actually do have a choice, but that choice seems so absurd to me now. I'm just not going to do it.
That makes complete sense. I love analogies. I love the visuals of that. And that's the thing. And nobody would know if I drank out of the toilet. It would be my personal thing, but I would know. Mm-hmm. And do I really want to do that? Will I have long-term repercussions? Maybe, maybe not. Do I want to risk that? No, I don't think so. And it's just, I mean, here's a prime example. It's like, I have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is an autoimmune disease that caused a nodule to grow on my throat, and I had to have it removed. And from now on, I have to take Synthroid every day to regulate my thyroid levels. Well, since that's happened, you know, I've felt better, but I noticed when I went, you know, here we go, Pepper. Here's time for everybody to roll their eyes. ever since I went gluten-free, things have changed for me so that I don't need a midday nap. My joints aren't aching. Mm-hmm. I'm not tired all the time. My stomach feels better. I just have tons more energy. And when I do eat gluten, I pass out immediately. It's like taking a sleeping pill. So my boyfriend and I have both done this. He's most likely has celiac. He has not gotten diagnosed, but he breaks out in rashes when he eats gluten. So we both stopped doing this. And if we both decide to splurge and just say, screw it, or, you know, if we're out, you know, wherever, and we don't care, we'll eat whatever, a pizza or pasta or something. We feel it for the next 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our hangover. And we have to judge, okay, well, was it worth it? Some days, yeah. If I don't have anything to do the next day, I can deal with the stomach ache. I can deal with my joints aching. I can deal with the tiredness. That's fine. But if I've got something to do the next day, I'm fully aware of the repercussions. Plus, it's overall bad for me. So It's kind of stupid. And a lot of times we say, yeah, that wasn't worth it. Why did we do that? And so, I mean, addiction still manifests itself in numerous ways. I mean, that's the embarrassing part. I'm a smart person that uses common sense, logic, critical thinking. I know this is going to be the effect, and yet I still do it because part of me thinks for some reason it won't affect me. And that's...
That's human.
Insanity. Yeah. Insanity.
Is it insanity or is it just human nature? Because I think is anybody free from doing that? I don't know. Does anybody get out of that? I'd love to meet someone who just never makes that mistake, because I haven't found anybody like that yet. But maybe you know different people than I do. I don't
well,
know.
Like I said, addiction manifests itself in numerous ways. So yeah. It's not just drugs and alcohol, because, you know, obviously there have been times, I mean, especially during finals week and everything, you know, work times where I'm like, wow, a beer would be fantastic right now. Or, oh, this is a delicious meal. A glass of wine would be incredible. Yeah, it would be. But do I want to deal with the repercussions? No. Is it my ego that's keeping me clean and sober? Possibly. Whatever does it. Mm-hmm. You know, sobriety for me is just, it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing written. I don't know of anybody that says, I'm so glad I drank because blank would never have happened if I didn't.
Hmm.
Yeah. I've just never heard a story where that's happened. Whereas I've heard of, oh God, I wish I didn't drink because blank probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, that's a good point. I've never thought of it like that. Yeah. Oh,
life,
man,
is really good and great. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It's a gift. It truly is a gift. And I remember, you know, it took me a good 3 years total to get out from under, you know, a cloud of weed.
Mm-hmm.
Even after I got clean. And I used to go around saying, I'm sorry, I used to be smarter than this.
Mm.
And I remember when the fog lifted and I was so thankful. And I said, you know, I will never, never get to that point ever again, because I was worried that I wouldn't have my cognitive functioning again. And I'm thankful. I'm just really, really thankful.
Well, yeah, and that's funny, because now where you live, now it seems like weed is so prevalent. It's not like how it is. Now, in Pennsylvania, they just passed a marijuana law, and they're moving very quickly towards legalizing it, because now you don't get in trouble. It's not criminalized in Pittsburgh and in Philly anymore. You don't get, for small amounts of weed, you don't get anything except, I think, $50 fine or something now. And so they're moving quickly to decriminalize weed here. But in California, it's a whole different set of circumstances where it's pretty darn, well, at least I get the impression, it's pretty darn common. And so having had your experiences, do you think that people are blind to it and people kind of lost in a fog? Or do you think the attitudes are different? Like, what do you sense from just your experience and your kind of your surroundings?
I know that weed has gotten even a lot stronger than when I was smoking it back in 1995. Mm-hmm. It's had 20 years to be cultivated and developed, and now you have stores on every corner out here where, mm-hmm. you know, they have menus that you look at. It's like going into a coffee shop in Amsterdam and checking that out. What I don't like weed smokers. I just think that it makes you lazy. Mm-hmm. That's my personal belief. I feel that it kills your motivation and it kills your creativity. And, you know, I'm thankful that my boyfriend has now quit, because mm-hmm. for a while he was using while I was clean. And that was hard. Mm. It was very hard because I knew it's like I knew exactly what his motivations were. And it's like he's like, oh, no. This is the only thing that makes me happy and not depressed. I was there, but it depresses your system. Mm-hmm. And it's just now he's getting the, oh, my gosh, fog's lifted. He's thankful because he used to never remember his dreams. Now he's able to lucid dream and he's thrilled about that. He can't stop talking to all his friends who are now probably really annoyed with him for talking about it by saying, I can control my dreams now and I remember every single one and it's better than any time that I was mm-hmm. ever on weed and I never want to do it again. And, you know, and that was a personal choice for him. But, you know, he meets with a lot of resistance on that. Yeah. And out here, it's so prevalent. It just is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm thankful that I'm away from the Hollywood thing where cocaine is just what you do or ecstasy is just what you do. And I think no matter where it's like Buckaroo Banzai, no matter where you go, there you are. It's going to be there wherever you go in some form. And you just have to have the tools in your tool belt in order to be able to say, I'm okay with myself as is. I'm okay with the situation. Oh, God, this is a party. I don't know anyone here. Mm-hmm. I'm uncomfortable. And be able to sit in that uncomfortableness. Now I think our new, you know, drugs are cell phones.
Mm-hmm. They're the new cigarettes or something.
That's absolutely the new cigarette, because it used to be you smoke cigarette, you know, if you're standing on the corner, people are like, what is that person doing standing on the corner? Mm-hmm. Then, you know, if you're smoking a cigarette, then everybody's, oh, she's smoking.
Yeah, it's the nervous habit or whatever. And
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. Because you almost feel like you shouldn't be just sitting there. There must be something wrong with you. I have felt anxious like that too. And then I was like, you know, I can actually just sit on a park bench and just look around. And yeah, it might look weird, but I don't fit in anymore just doing that. But there was a time kind of recently when you could just sit on a park bench and look around and not be like some weirdo.
Yeah. Well, now people think that you're a weirdo. And that's not okay, but I guess it is what it is. But it's hard because, I mean, people can't even sit with themselves in their car anymore. That's why you have so many problems with texting and driving, because they can't even sit with their thoughts for 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I probably should wrap this up, Carrie, but if you wanted to close out with anything, whether it's something that you're working on or some parting words of wisdom or anything else, this is your time to shine.
No, my time. No pressure. Just be good to each other. There's really enough pain in this world and, you know, enough misery that you don't really need to add to it. And just make sure you take care of yourself first and foremost, because, you know, your life is a gift. Mm-hmm. And treat it as such. It's a very special thing.
Thank you so much, Carrie. You're my favorite rock star too.
Well, thank you. You're my favorite podcast.
Come to sparkmymuse.com for show notes to this episode and all episodes. There will be links to the people, books, and resources mentioned in the show, and sometimes you'll find photos or embedded videos too, and lots of other goodies.